Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, we'll discuss an issue state lawmakers could take up before the end of the month, repealing the parental notification of abortion law for those underage. We'll hear the arguments for and against it. Illinois wants to become a leader in electric vehicles. It's trying to help develop the market for them with tax credits on purchases, more on what the state is doing. The Great Chicago Fire was 150 years ago this month. One myth was that nearly everything in the city was destroyed. We'll explain why that's false. Getting back to class was important for students, but after a year of remote learning, some teachers are dealing with behavioral problems in their classrooms. And bringing the farm to schools. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, we'll hear how some students coming back into the classroom has also meant classroom disruptions. The state of Illinois is working to get more people to buy electric vehicles. We'll hear details on that. And what buildings survived the Great Chicago Fire? We'll find out all ahead on Statewide. Illinois lawmakers are back for their fall session this month, and one of the key issues under discussion is doing away with what's known as the parental notification law, meaning a parent or guardian needs to be informed prior to an underage girl getting an abortion. The issue has come up many times before. In fact, it was debated in the spring. At that time, Maureen McKinney listened to the different arguments for and against. She produced this report.
Stories about keeping or repealing Illinois' Parental Notification Act sound somewhat similar. Both sides say it protects rights, but whose? Teens or parents? While Illinois has extensive abortion rights on the books, parental notification is a holdover from more than two decades ago. Dr. Brooke Bellow couldn't tell a parent she was having abortions. The counselor and author is founder of the organization More to Life. She said she is a survivor of human trafficking and a preteen rape. Early in her teens, she was forced to have multiple abortions by her traffickers. Those procedures left her unable to bear children. Scarred, she had to have multiple operations, including a hysterectomy.
If I had my parent been notified, my mother would have known what city I was in. She would have known what street I possibly would have been near. She could have contacted law enforcement.
Bellow spoke at a press conference for a coalition called Parents for the Protection of Girls. It was formed to block repeal of Illinois' PNA.
Why would you want a child to keep something secret that's going to affect the rest of her life?
Supporters of repealing laws say there are times when notifying a parent within the two-day window is just not possible. Bridget Leahy is with Planned Parenthood Illinois Action. The group is the political arm of Planned Parenthood of Illinois.
The only young people who this truly impacts are those who are in family situations where it is unsafe or dangerous or very ill-advised for them to involve that parent. But the rest are already doing so. You can't have a law that is going to make families be able to function well or talk well with each other.
Dr. Rebecca Comito, a Chicago obstetrician and gynecologist, argues that the PNA should be repealed. She talked about her experiences with teens seeking abortion.
When they do not involve a parent or guardian, young patients share with me that this is because they're concerned about judgment that may lead to social or financial isolation from their family, being forced out of their homes, or experiencing sexual or physical violence.
But the Reverend John Jones, a pastor at a Tinley Park church, said there are consequences of abortion for teens as well.
It seems unfathomable that the law would allow a minor to make a decision to access abortion without any adult guidance. We know the potential severe physical and emotional consequences associated with abortion. We cannot leave our children to face them alone.
Bob Gilligan is executive director of the Catholic Conference of Illinois. He agrees with Jones and notes that the law does not require consent, only notification.
So parents and guardians have to consent to just about anything a child wants to do today. Field trips, medication in schools, joining sport. We have laws that protect parents and treat children differently because we know that teens are impulsive. They engage in risky behavior, and science tells us that their brains are not even fully formed until 25.
But Bridget Leahy of Planned Parenthood points out that other actions related to pregnancy do not require parental consent or notification. Those include prenatal testing and care and procedures including a cesarean section or giving up a child for adoption. Neither do testing and treatment for sexually transmitted infections and sexual assault and mental health and substance abuse counseling. Emily Worth is an ACLU attorney who works with teens who seek judicial bypass. In the 7 years the law has been enforced, more than 500 teens have sought the alternative to parental notification. They go before a judge to explain why they can't tell a parent they want to have an abortion. There are clients, she said, who were delayed so long by the bypass process that it was too late for them to have an abortion.
And it's these young people that we could not help and who may have ended up parenting before they were really ready. Those are the ones that haunt me.
I'm Maureen McKinney.
And Maureen joins me now. Maureen, since you reported on this story in the spring, abortion rights advocates seem to have become more energized and it seems more are focused on getting rid of parental notification in Illinois. And since that time also, Texas approved a law that effectively bans abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Has that been one of the issues that has spurred people?
It has. I think it's energized abortion rights supporters and progressives in both chambers. There's a desire to keep Illinois as a haven for abortion services, being that it's the only state in the Midwest that doesn't have some strict restrictions.
Yeah, Illinois is quite progressive when it comes to reproductive rights. How does it rank across the country, just in a general sense?
The Guttmacher Institute, which tracks abortion laws and advocates for reproductive rights, said Illinois is the most progressive state in the nation on abortion rights, with the notable exception of the parental notification law that's been enforced since 2013.
There are a lot of people who wanted to get rid of this before, and yet here we are with certainly Democrats in control of the legislature through all of that time. It still hasn't happened, at least up to this point. Any idea why that has taken so long for them to get this done?
Illinois passed the Reproductive Health Act in 2019, which really made abortion a fundamental right in Illinois. But the Parental Notification Act didn't come up. It didn't come up in 2020 or in this spring's session. I think the case we talked about in Texas and one that is expected to go before the Supreme Court later in the year really sparked interest in this issue.
That's reporter Maureen McKinney. She's been following efforts to repeal Illinois' law requiring parental notification before abortion. Lawmakers could vote before the end of this month. Climate change is impacting everyone, and farmers are noticing it. Just in time for the fall growing season, Jody Holtz talked with Evan Berry, owner of Downriver Farm in East Peoria.
I started Downriver Farm in 2017. I ended up meeting my partner at that point, so we just kind of hit the ground running, and we had a lot of ambition and passion and channeled it all into these businesses.
As the fall rolls in, what kind of changes do you expect to see on the farm, and how do you anticipate the fall season will go?
The whole season, to me, is very cyclical, so we start off in the spring with a lot of the radishes, root crops, and greens, so salad mixes and spinach and all that stuff. And then fall, we kind of go back into that, those greens, but then we also have garlic, and we also have winter squash, and some of those other staple crops that we think of around fall time.
climate change has and continues to affect many farms and their operations. How has Downriver Farm been impacted?
My mentor, Henry Brockman, from what he's told me, it was substantially easier to farm when he was younger. Generally milder in the summer and even getting colder colds in the winter. But then also the biggest thing he's mentioned is erratic rainfalls. You know, we don't really have like gentle rains anymore. It's mostly downpours or long periods of drought. And we really have to adjust our crop offerings because of that. And then we just have to make sure that we're treating the soil that much better. So we're always trying to find ways of also just kind of reducing tillage. Because as soon as we till in the spring, if that soil isn't covered by either a crop or a mulch, it's going to dry out really fast once that summer heat hits. So yeah, we're always, that's another thing we're always refining is like, how do we make this farm more climate resilient?
So does organic farming have less climate impact than other methods?
Yeah, you have to think about the farm in a holistic way when you're farming organically. There's no short-term solutions to problems. Farming starts with soil health. Generally speaking, organic soils are going to be much healthier. They're going to have more organic matter in them. They have more bacteria and fungal life. It's not creating off-gases. To me, organic sort of gets to the heart of soil health.
In your opinion, what does it mean to be organic?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I think that word has been taken over. It's become a marketing ploy. The whole idea of organic to me is that this soil can be farmed in the future. That's the only way that we as a society are going to be judged is the health of our soil for our children. Can they get healthy food from it where they don't have to put crazy synthetic fertilizers in like they are?
I know the farm offers a variety of CSAs for the public to subscribe to. Could you explain what a CSA is and what options you have available currently?
So a CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. So for our regular season, we have a 25-week regular season CSA. That one you pay for in the winter. And then we also have our fall CSA, and it goes from October 2nd to November 6th. You basically get 8 items each week. I should say we also do weekly shares. Basically, I put together whatever's the freshest during that week, and then you can purchase that. We usually put it on our website on Sundays, and then you can just buy it week to week. And those actually are delivered also to your door.
How can people in the community continue to support their local farms and farmers?
Yeah, just keep showing up at market. It's always helpful when people sort of think about going to the market as grocery shopping. I think that it's much easier to come to the market and have this mentality of, let's go see what they have.
That's Evan Berry of Downriver Farm in East Peoria. He was speaking with Jody Holtz. He started his farm in 2017. Even in America's breadbasket, many children know more about TikTok than livestock. But some schools are making farm work into classwork. And as Katie Pikus reports, they've built chicken coops and sheep pens near the playgrounds in ways that seem to pay off in the classroom.
Welcome to Chicken Town!
Students at Marnie Simons Elementary in Hamburg, Iowa, spend a lot of time doing chores on the school's mini farm, a chicken coop, and pens for pigs, sheep, and goats. On this day, the children help farm school coordinator Spencer Baldwin trim the chickens' wings.
Okay, we'll spread that out. Bam, bam. See, it doesn't even care.
The small Southwest Iowa school district has 50 chickens, 4 sheep, 3 goats, and 2 piglets. Students learn the basics of livestock anatomy and diet. But Baldwin says there's a larger lesson.
The biggest thing the kids learn is just how to treat the animals, how to interact with them. You know, especially these little kids, my kindergartners out here, when we were first out here, they like to run and chase me, you know, and they don't mean anything by it. They just want to be around them. They want to pet them, want to snuggle them, whatever.
But Baldwin says the younger kids quickly learned not to stress the animals by chasing them. The older children, like fifth grader Kayla McIntosh, put in some real farm work. She wants to help deliver the sheep's babies this spring.
I've never lived on a farm, so I actually want to experience it.
Most kids in the town of 1,100 people don't live on a farm, but the majority of Hamburg students get in on farm school. And some teachers say it's affected their classes in a good way. First grade teacher Michelle Hendrickson says her students gravitate towards reading books about farm animals.
They do dive into the farm animals and want to learn more about the chickens and more so the animals that we've had on the farm have sparked an interest in their reading.
She says her students have become more productive because they're eager to finish tasks so they can help out on the farm. But it's not all cute chicks and playful swine. Hamburg Superintendent Mike Wells says the farm teaches children a work ethic, and maintaining a farm at a school is a lot of work.
On weekends, who takes care of the animals? You have to set up a system of kids who are dependable to come in and feed and take care of the animals.
Wells says if someone doesn't lock up the chickens at night, raccoons or possums could kill them. This is the farm school's fifth year. It started after a group of students incubated some chicken eggs. Those eggs became chicks that grew up and needed a home. Students had to get special permission from the city council because local laws forbid livestock in town.
All these buildings out here were built by kids. They're not perfect, but it was their design and they built it.
A few other Iowa schools have small farm schools too, and several schools in Columbia, Missouri raise chickens. Iowa 4-H Youth Development's Ben Pullen says the number of children who live on farms and raise livestock for 4-H projects is shrinking.
Which is where having these special projects, having these different opportunities allows for youth to engage in these things that maybe didn't have that opportunity otherwise.
And with the number of farms also decreasing, people fall out of touch with where their food comes from. Natalie Carroll is a professor of agricultural science, education, and communication at Purdue University. She says a school farm can help make city kids understand farm life.
Our food doesn't just come from the store. It doesn't just show up magically. And they gain an appreciation for how much it takes to raise food, the choices that have to be made.
That's an important lesson at Hamburg's farm school. The piglets, the kids call them breakfast and lunch, will be slaughtered at the end of the school year. Farm school coordinator Spencer Baldwin says that topic will come up.
It can be a tough lesson to learn, but it's a good thing to learn, especially in an agricultural community here. You know, a lot of them have been exposed to that.
Baldwin says a few of the younger children get emotional, but the older kids help them through. Even those tough lessons feed into a hands-on education in agriculture, all part of a window into farm life for young children.
Katie Pikus with that report. There's more ahead on Statewide. Now back in class, some students are behaving badly. That story is on the way. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, the novelty of being back in person is starting to wear off in some schools. Teachers are having to catch students up to academic standards after many fell behind during remote learning. But adjusting to school habits has been hard, and it's creating daily classroom disruptions. Susie Yan reports.
Classroom pranks and a few squabbles between students is par for the course when it comes to school. But this fall, after a year when many students stayed home, those classroom antics are more serious and frequent, including some prompted by social media challenges.
Very early on in the year, we had notifications from the school administration about TikTok and devious licks, and they had been made aware of it, and then there had been a few incidents.
After a year of being mostly remote, Angie Gatsiak's kids were excited to be back fully in person. But parents at the Chicago Elementary School were soon notified that kids were vandalizing the bathrooms. She says kids were stealing from the teacher and other students, including her fifth grade daughter.
For my oldest, I mean, she still sees things in black and white, you know, like there's good choices and there's bad choices. She was so sort of shocked.
Parents and teachers say they're seeing more kids acting out at school. In younger classrooms, kids are more physical with their classmates. Older students sometimes pulled pranks they found on the internet before the pandemic. But more students seem to be jumping on the bandwagon. In Glenview, one of those social media challenges had a middle school boy throwing a chair out of a window. That chair hit a girl in the head, seriously injuring her. A first grade teacher in the U46 school district out in Elgin says a lot of schools are focusing on recovering learning loss, but she doesn't think enough attention is being paid to help kids regulate their emotions.
It really does boil down to the behavior piece and the emotional social readiness that our kids have right now, which is quite honestly about 2 years behind what we typically see.
The teacher didn't want to use her name for fear of retaliation from her district. She says simple accidents like one child bumping into another quickly escalates, and she has to stop lessons to calm everyone down. Kids are fighting over little things like taking turns. She says teachers were expecting some regression, but the degree of how long it's taking to get back to basics has been a shock.
We have all these things that we have to do to, you know, make up for that learning loss and all of these new things put on teachers. But again, none of it is addressing that really big issue, which is they are so behind socially and emotionally, I can't even begin to address the academics.
She says some parents are expecting teachers to right the ship, but the school is not providing enough support. Andrea Goss is with the Erickson Institute, an early childhood education graduate program. She says there's been real trauma and anxiety over the past year and a half.
If the teachers aren't okay, then the students are not okay. If the students are not okay, the administrators are not okay. It's a parallel process.
She says, of course, student safety is a priority and kids need to be separated if there's a fight. But she says there needs to be an understanding of where all of this is coming from. Parents may be unaware that kids are soaking up mom and dad's anxiety.
We've had to deal with that for over a year, right? The ups and downs of the pandemic, the transitions, the uncertainty, the fear. And so, rightfully so, kids are going to carry that with them because it's what they've been experiencing for so long.
She says parents and schools need to work together to bring that self-regulation back in line. This is where federal COVID relief dollars can be put to good use for more mental health services. At Crete Moni High School in the south suburbs, the district spent federal funds to hire more counselors. The district has seen a rise in behavioral issues compared to pre-pandemic times. Sarah Gruber is a student advocate counselor who came on before the pandemic. She says more kids are coming to visit her.
We're seeing students not really know how to be around other people and a lot of anxiety of being around other people.
The school is pushing restorative justice and trying to reduce suspensions. They've also enlisted therapy dogs, which has been a big hit for students.
There's no playbook. Like, nobody gave us any rules for how this is going to happen or when it's going to end.
She says there's no one single solution. It's a matter of schools and parents banding together to help recover what was lost during the pandemic. Susie Ahn, WBEZ News.
The number of individuals hospitalized with COVID-19 remains high across the country and in the Midwest. With the Delta variant dominating cases, patients now are younger, sicker, often require more intensive care. Natalie Krebs with Side Effects Public Media checked in with one hospital still facing pressure.
On the eighth floor of Iowa Methodist Hospital in downtown Des Moines, 56-year-old Russell Braley watches daytime TV in one of the recovery units. He's breathing through a tube running from his nose to an oxygen unit.
I've been in motorcycle wrecks. I've almost died several times in my lifetime. This was the scariest thing I've ever been through.
Braley lives in Des Moines and is talking about his recent battle with COVID-19, which he says nearly killed him. A month ago, Braley arrived at Methodist by ambulance. He was so sick he couldn't get out of bed. And like most COVID-19 patients, he's unvaccinated.
It's like drowning above water. I mean, if you can't breathe, there's nothing else scarier.
A year and a half into the pandemic, the system Methodist Hospital is part of no longer has designated COVID units. Instead, patients are scattered around in different departments depending on their needs.
Floor number one. Going down.
They lay in beds hooked up to tubes, some on ventilators. Those under isolation precautions have the same note taped on the closed doors of their rooms, reminding staff to take extra precautions before entering. Every day, Julie Gibbons and her team count them all. She manages infection prevention. She points to a printed off graph resting on her briefcase.
So here's a nice little graph.
It shows the hospital system's COVID case count in Des Moines since March of last year. But Gibbons says this current wave is clearly different. It's lasting much longer.
We've been at this high level between 65 and 70, I think seven patients for 2.5 months. That's a lot of COVID patients.
On the day I'm visiting, the hospital system's Des Moines facilities have 66 patients with active COVID cases. This means they're still testing positive for the virus. It's the system's official COVID count. But Gibbons says in reality, there's also about 24 additional COVID patients who now test negative for the virus and are labeled as recovered. But they're still in the hospital, fighting its effects.
some of them won't ever get off the ventilator and will die even as COVID recovered because they just, their lungs were just so damaged.
The sickest patients are in the intensive care unit, where nurses like Jelana Valbrecht care for them, often for weeks. Valbrecht says in her 15 years working at the hospital, she's never seen the ICU this full.
Every day it seems like we're trying to get patients out of the ICU so that way we can get patients into the ICU.
This kind of deep, prolonged stress is affecting all kinds of healthcare workers, and it's leading to workforce shortages for many hospitals like Methodist.
It's taken a huge toll on our department.
Lisa Kingery is the supervisor for the respiratory care team, which sees every COVID patient in the hospital. Kingery says her team has many vacant positions right now.
We've had a lot of seasoned staff quit, go to different professions, go to different institutions. You know, everybody's very tired and very burned out. Mm-hmm.
But with many COVID infection rates still high and vaccinations still lagging across the Midwest, the reality is many people will need hospitals like Methodist in the coming months. Back on the 8th floor recovery unit, 52-year-old Brenton Harmison wipes tears from his eyes as he recounts how the hospital saved his life.
It gave me a second chance to live again. It's pretty emotional. I didn't think I was that close to being dead. COVID ain't no joke.
Harmison says he wants everyone to get vaccinated. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Natalie Krebs.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker last month signed a massive new law overhauling Illinois' energy portfolio to combat climate change. But the state is looking at a long road to another goal in that new law, getting 1 million new electric vehicles in Illinois on the highways. Caroline Kobzanski has this story.
The so-called Climate and Equitable Jobs Act puts Illinois on the path to getting 100% of its energy from renewable sources like wind or solar power in the next 3 decades. The ambitious climate package also has a secondary goal to reduce carbon emissions in the state. By 2030, Governor J.B. Pritzker wants to see 1 million new electric vehicles displace traditional fuel-burning cars on Illinois roads. Emissions from cars and trucks have overtaken coal plants as the largest source of pollution in Illinois in recent years, boosted by the proliferation of rideshare and demands for near-instant delivery for online shoppers. But Jack Darren, the director of Sierra Club Illinois, is optimistic that investing in electric vehicles or EVs will pay dividends everywhere.
We get not only the savings as drivers from not having to put gas in our cars anymore, we get the cleaner air, but also hopefully we're creating good jobs in manufacturing for Illinois and making these vehicles and these charging technologies.
According to state data, there are currently 26,000 EVs registered in Illinois. But the new climate law includes $4,000 tax credits meant to incentivize Illinoisans to buy new EVs beginning next summer. That's on top of an existing $7,500 federal tax credit for new EV buyers. But if 1 million new Illinoisans do start driving EVs in the next 9 years, the state will need much more infrastructure to support the shift, including a massive investment in charging stations. Illinois currently has about 2,200 charging stations statewide, but it'll need to amp that number to about 100,000 by 2030. That's according to Megha Lakchara, the policy director at electric vehicle charger maker EVBox. But the price tag, at least for now, isn't cheap.
If you bought something with a single port, the hardware costs approximately $2,000. Installation depends on the electric wiring and the infrastructure upgrade that is needed. So it can range from anything from $2,000 to $6,000.
Really fast chargers, which can re-energize a car in 15 minutes, can cost up to $70,000 or $80,000, with $150,000 in infrastructure costs to get them connected to the electric grid. Lakchara says the longer the state takes to implement the infrastructure, the harder it will get.
They can accommodate the influx of all these electric vehicles within the next 4 or 5. The problem is if you do nothing. Based on the current infrastructure, it could get difficult. You could have choke points.
Though Illinois' business community largely opposed the massive climate law citing increased energy costs, trade groups are hopeful the state can attract new EV-centric businesses. Lakchara's company, EVBox, put down roots in Illinois last year when it made Libertyville its North American headquarters. And Illinois is already home to 2 EV manufacturing plants. Mark Densler, the president and CEO of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, says there's no reason that Illinois, at the heart of the U.S. interstate highway system with a major city and an international airport, shouldn't get serious consideration as the home base for new EV companies.
We have a well-skilled population here in the state of Illinois. Workforce is certainly very important.
However, Densler warns that property taxes and the higher energy costs his group opposed in the climate law could give companies pause when they're weighing whether to invest in Illinois. But there are things Illinois could do to sweeten the deal for EV manufacturers, Densler says, like speeding up the permit process for new ventures and giving out tax incentives. State Representative Dave Vella, a Democrat from Rockford, has already introduced legislation to provide EV companies with those incentives. The proposal would create tax credits for EV manufacturers and EV battery makers, in addition to utilities incorporating renewable energy into their grids.
We're talking about chip manufacturing and battery manufacturing and wiring and all this stuff. So we're talking about tens of thousands of new jobs, hundreds of thousands of man hours of construction to put this infrastructure in place. It really could boom our economy back to post-World War II times when a vast majority of our people were working in manufacturing.
Lawmakers will likely consider Vella's proposal and other EV-related matters in the spring. I'm Caroline Kubsansky.
As more states approve medical or recreational marijuana, they have to figure out how to regulate production. In Oklahoma, for example, nearly 10% of the population has a medical marijuana card, and that's causing a boom in growers across the state. As Seth Bodine reports, the demand for water and electricity is straining some rural utilities.
Inside a big metal building outside Stillwater, Oklahoma, Adam Miller fills up a big tank of water. Miller is the head grower of the marijuana business Iris Farms, where he's responsible for caring for about 5,000 growing cannabis plants. That takes lights, fans, and water. He says his electric bill can be up to $3,000 a month. But his water bill? It's pretty low, only about $40 a month. Miller says that's different from growing outdoors.
I'm watering individual plants, a half gallon of water at a time, and they're irrigating a field, and the space between the rows and everything else is absorbing all that water, so they just got to use a lot of it.
Over the past 9 months, 8 cannabis growers have moved to Hughes County. As Sheldon Tatum drives his truck on a dirt road, he stops and points out what may be a new outdoor farm.
I don't know. I'm not going to get out there and climb over the gate.
Tatum is a rural water district manager. He provides water to all residents in his service area. But there's one thing he's sure of. Some farms take a lot of water.
I had one last month that was 223,000 gallons.
Tatum worries the recent increase in water use will cause breaks in the old piping, which would add to utility bills.
We've got water systems that were built 50, 60 years ago being asked to perform to standards today that are just outside of its capacity.
Since Oklahomans approved medical marijuana in 2018, the number of licensed cannabis growers has exploded to more than 8,000 to meet the state's demand. For Tom Whitaker, a water district manager in Wynnewood, Oklahoma, meeting growers' demands for water comes down to resources.
Based on the numbers that I'm seeing, I will run out of water.
Whitaker says he's sold 40 million gallons of water so far this year. He expects that'll double, which is dangerously close to the amount of water the state's resources board has given them, which is why he's cutting people off at 10,000 gallons a month.
Because if I start pumping over pumping, I start robbing from my neighbor over here, and then he don't have any water, and then pretty soon nobody has water, and that's our challenge.
Cannabis does take water to grow, but Chris Dillis, a researcher at UC Berkeley, says the plant isn't thirstier than other irrigated crops.
When cannabis is grown in areas that are more home to traditional agriculture, it's really not all that different from other crops in terms of water requirements.
But it's not just water.
These growers are using as much power as a small city.
That's Logan Pleasant, the director of operations at Lake Region Electric Cooperative. He says there's more than 100 growers that use their electric system. If this keeps up, Pleasant says the co-op will have to buy new substations and even install new power lines. That would cost thousands of dollars, and the price tag would be shared by each member of the co-op. But if the marijuana boom turns into a bust, that could be a problem.
Many of these locations will either close up shop or they will scale back significantly if the market wanes.
And that's a very real possibility. John Hudak is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution who studies marijuana policy.
There are far too many growers. There are far too many dispensaries in that state for the number of patients that there are.
The Oklahoma Medical Marijuana Authority doesn't regulate how much water and electricity growers use, but a spokesperson says it plans to work closely with municipalities and agencies like Oklahoma's water and energy boards on finding solutions. In the meantime, local utility managers will have to make hard decisions about what they do with limited resources and growing demand. Seth Bodine, Harvest Public Media.
Still ahead on Statewide, the Great Chicago Fire, what survived? That's next. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Great Chicago Fire happened 150 years ago this month, a major disaster. But not everything was wiped off the map, and we know that thanks to a map. Member station WBEZ's Curious City podcast brings us the story.
Stephen L. Robinson was a Western Union telegraph operator working in Chicago in 1871. Back then, Robinson's job was incredibly important because the telegraph was the only way to instantly communicate the news. Robinson, like around 100,000 others, had just lost his house in what would soon be called the Great Chicago Fire. As soon as it was safe, he grabbed a pencil and a printed map of what had been Chicago and walked the length of the fire's path. His aim? To note any buildings that had survived the fire. I'm Curious City producer Jason Mark, and we're going to hear about some buildings that Robinson noted on his map with some help from historian Paul DeRica. And he's joining me now to talk about what's coming up. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Jason.
Well, Curious City has received a lot of questions about the fire over the years, including several people who have asked us about what actually survived the Great Chicago Fire.
Yes, there were actually a number of buildings that survived, which Stephen Robinson documented.
Wait, when I was a kid, we were taught two things about the fire. Mrs. O'Leary's cow started it by kicking over a lantern, and everything in the whole town burned down except one building, the water tower.
Yeah, and that's what most people are taught. But number one, the whole cow thing, it's been debunked. In an era of anti-Irish sentiment, Catherine O'Leary was an easy scapegoat for the press and the public to pin the blame on. And number two, the idea that the whole town burned down ignores a simple fact. Chicago's boundaries didn't match the fire's path. Yes, Chicago was a young city, but it was growing rapidly, and by 1871 it had a west and a south side that were left largely undamaged by the fire.
So that's a decent chunk of territory we're talking about. Is there anything still around today in those areas that we can see?
Yes. Lots of houses, churches, old factory buildings. But I'll give you two landmarks most Chicagoans know. Hall House, on the west side, which was built by Charles Hall in 1856. Jane Addams and Ellen Gates Starr didn't open their settlement house there until 1889. And the Union Stockyards, which had opened on the south side Christmas Day, 1865.
All right, wait. So if it missed all these other parts of the city, where exactly did the fire burn?
The path of the fire ran from Roosevelt Road up to Fullerton Avenue, and from the lake west to just a little past the Chicago River. The fire actually started west of the river, jumped it once, spread north and east, and jumped the river a second time to devastate the north side.
Okay, but if we just stick to the burned out parts, surely, right, the water tower is the sole survivor. It became this rallying point around which Chicagoans rebuilt their city. It's this civic symbol of resilience.
Yeah, well, it's true that the water tower became a major symbol of the city, but it wasn't the only structure in the fire zone to survive. Luckily, we have Robinson's list, and I'm going to tell you about one on the list and two that didn't make this list, but I promise you, their stories are fascinating and worth hearing. The most notable structure on Stephen Robinson's map was the Ogden House. Malan Ogden was a prominent lawyer and the brother of William Butler Ogden, who served as the city's first mayor. You might know the name Ogden from the high school in West Town or Ogden Avenue, which runs from the near west side all the way out to Aurora. Not only was William Butler Ogden the first mayor, he made a fortune in real estate and railroads, investments he brought his brother into when Malan moved to Chicago. And by 1871, Malan Ogden was living with his second wife and three children in a two-story mansion, just north of the fashionable Washington Square Park. The park still exists today at Clark and Walton on the near north side. Malan Ogden and his family weren't at home when the fire struck. Their house was saved thanks to the efforts of some guests staying there and presumably the family servants. The open space of Washington Square Park slowed the fire's advance, while those inside took everything made of cloth, curtains, carpets, blankets, sheets, soaked them in well water, and then cider from the cellar. Even hard cider, in case you're curious, isn't flammable. Then they wrapped the outside of the house like a mummy and waited out the flames. When the fire had passed and eventually was extinguished by the rain that fell on October 9th, Washington Square Park lay in ruins. Its majestic elm trees had been reduced to ash. Its elegant iron fencing had melted into large, tangled lumps. But the Ogden House stood unscathed. The Tribune reported, quote, "The house of Mr. Malin D. Ogden on Dearborn and Lafayette Place was not even scorched." In the days following, tents began to appear in Washington Square Park as refugees from the fire took up temporary residence there. Outside help arrived, but so did those who saw opportunity amid the ruins. People photographed the Ogden House and turned the images into stereoscope cards that were sold all across the country. In fact, Chicagoans began to explore the city and take photos almost immediately after the blaze died down. And people from other cities visited as well, touring the smoldering wreckage as if they were looking at the ruins of ancient Greece or Rome. More than two decades later, readers of the Chicago Tribune opened up the October 9, 1893 edition and were gifted with a full-color illustration of the Ogden House. The accompanying text proclaimed, quote, "As the sole survivor on the north side, it will always be famous." This was the year of the World's Columbian Exposition, and October 9th was Chicago Day at the World's Fair. The special ticket for that day included an illustration of the mythical phoenix rising from the flames, for that was how Chicago saw itself 22 years after the fire, a city reborn. But Chicagoans wouldn't have been able to see the Malin Ogden House on that day. Soon after the fire, Ogden suffered financial reversals, and the trustees of the Newberry Estate saw an opportunity to snatch up some valuable land. They tore down the Ogden House and erected, to quote the 1893 Tribune article again, the magnificent new Newberry Library building. Yes, it's true. It's where I work. Although that same article called it, quote, "the one distinctive mark of the greatest conflagration of all time," there were no protests when the Ogden House came down. The public's ideas about what was important and worth saving were different back then. And as the article goes on to say, quote, "in Chicago, all things change." As we head north on Stephen Robinson's map, we arrive in Lincoln Park. And this next building is a survivor of the fire, but not in the way you might think. The owner called it, quote, "an American curiosity," and it was curious indeed. It was called the Relic House because every brick and stone, every piece of melted glass and twisted metal that formed the walls had been salvaged from the ruins of the fire. It was a Frankenstein's monster of a building, made up of the bits and pieces of at least 20 others. For 10 years, the house seems to have been a private home. Then it was sold and moved to where it became a saloon. Various everyday objects that survived the fire hung on its walls. A large painting depicting the fire reminded visitors of the scale of the disaster. While the phrase wouldn't have been used at the time, the Relic House was a tourist trap. In 1920, the Relic House was taken over by Dr. Ben L. Reitman. Reitman was an interesting man. He was an iconoclast who ran in bohemian circles. It was the 1920s, and Reitman promoted birth control and STD awareness, attended to the medical needs of the homeless, and even performed abortions before they were legal. After getting tossed out of an infamous hipster hideaway known as the Dill Pickle Club, Reitman founded what he called the House of Blazes. The Tribune proclaimed, quote, "poetry in the Relic House? verse flowing where good beer foamed since Lincoln Park was a grassy plot. The House of Blazes lasted only a few months, and the Relic House lasted only a few more years. In February 1929, it was torn down, along with many of the surrounding buildings, to little fanfare. It was a victim of gentrification. The neighborhood was changing, the land was valuable, and a large apartment building with commercial space on the first level took its place. That building still stands and counts among its tenants another Chicago institution, one that mirrors the bric-a-brac aesthetic of the old Relic House, R.J. Grunt's. Up next, we follow Robinson's map to the biggest building on our tour and the only one left standing after the fire in the area we call the Loop. As we head south once more, we come to the largest and longest surviving structure that could have appeared on Stephen Robinson's map had he walked that far. It's called the Lind Block. It stood at the northwest corner of what is now Randolph Street and Wacker Drive. The five-story building was built by Sylvester Lind in the 1850s. Lind owned a lumberyard on the site, and his fleet of boats were tied just below the building, right on the river. But the boats Lind owned carried more than lumber. Lind was a staunch abolitionist and a key member of the Underground Railroad in Chicago. It's been written that escaped enslaved people would board one of his boats on the docks near the Lind Block and then sail from Chicago to freedom in Canada. By the fall of 1871, the year of the fire, Lind had sold the building, and the five floors of the Lind Block were leased to Z.M. Hall Wholesale Grocers. Zebulon Hall had come from the East, got a job as a bookkeeper, saved what he earned, and eventually invested in the ships that hauled grain across the Great Lakes. When the Great Fire started, Hall, his two sons, and the clerks from the firm fought back the flames. Water was hauled up in buckets from the river, and, like the Ogden House in our first story, blankets, curtains, and cloths were soaked and wrapped around the exterior. Later, Hall gained use of a small pump that made the river more accessible as he and his sons took to the roof. From there, they worked through the night to save the five-story building, while all around them, what is today the Loop, burned. As one of the only commercial buildings left standing after the fire, the Lind Block became a place of refuge. For 3 days, Hall freely gave away what had been in his grocery to fellow Chicagoans made homeless and destitute by the fire. Now, a connection to the Great Fire and the Underground Railroad should have made a good case for saving the Lind Block. But in a Tribune article in January 1963 titled "Oldest Building in Loop Succumbs to Progress," writer Will Leonard lamented the building's disappearance. Quote, "The snow of 111 winters had melted on the Lind Block's roof. The sunshine of 110 summers warmed its walls." Leonard went on to say, quote, "A few years ago, an officer of the engineering firm that owned the oldest building in downtown Chicago said proudly, 'It'll be here another 100 years. Today, they are tearing it down." Leonard seems to have been the only voice of protest. In 1968, 5 years after the Lind Block was torn down, the Commission on Chicago Landmarks was formed. These days, the commission and nonprofit organizations like Preservation Chicago work to preserve buildings like the Lind Block, which tell important pieces of Chicago's history. But why didn't anyone cry out in defense of these buildings years ago? Well, maybe the water tower, all massive bricks and spires, might fit the story we want to tell about ourselves better than the Ogden Mansion, the Relic House, or the Lind Block. Or maybe its survival is just a happy accident. The poet Carl Sandburg, who owns several stereoscope cards of the ruins from the Great Chicago Fire, once wrote Chicago is always, quote, building, breaking, rebuilding. Or, more simply, as the October 1893 article on the Ogden House put it, quote, "In Chicago, all things change." as for Stephen Robinson's map, it was donated to the Chicago Historical Society, today's Chicago History Museum, on the 90th anniversary of the fire, where, presumably, it survives.
Thanks to Paul DeRica with the Newberry Library in Chicago for that reporting on buildings that survived the Great Chicago Fire, which took place 150 years ago this month. That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Join us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And remember, you can find all of our episodes at nprillinois.org. Look for Statewide. And you can also catch our podcast through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.